some degree of what you call wasting away of old age. His physical functions overall have declined, and he seems to be losing the will to live. Normally, these symptoms don't emerge until the patient passes his mid-80s. When a person gets that old, we often see him grow tired of living and abandon the effort to maintain life. But I have no idea why that should be happening to a man in his 60s like Mr. Kawana. Tengo bit his lip and gave this some thought. "When did the coma start?" Tengo asked.
3 days ago," the doctor said.
"You mean he hasn't awakened for 3 days?"
"Not once."
"And his vital signs are gradually weakening," the doctor said. "Not drastically, but, as I just said, the level of his life-sustaining force is gradually, but visibly, going down, like a train dropping its speed little by little as it begins to stop."
"How much time do you think he has left?"
"I can't say for sure. If his present condition continues as is, he might have another week in the worst case," the doctor said. Tengo changed his grip on the receiver and bit his lip again. "I'll be there tomorrow," Tengo said. "Even if you hadn't called, I was thinking of going there soon. But I'm glad you called. I'm very grateful to you." The doctor seemed relieved to hear this. "Please do come. The sooner you see him, the better, I think. He may not be able to talk to you, but I'm sure your father will be glad you're here."
"He is completely unconscious, though, isn't he?"
"Yes, he is not conscious."
"Do you think he's in pain?"
"For now, no, probably not. That is the one silver lining in all this. He is sound asleep."
"Thank you very much," Tengo said.
"You know, Mr. Kawana," the doctor said, "your father was a very easy patient to take care of. He never gave anyone any trouble."
"He's always been like that," Tengo said.
Then, thanking the doctor once again, he ended the call. Tengo warmed his coffee and drank it at the kitchen table, sitting across from Fukaeri.
"You'll be leaving tomorrow?" Fukaeri asked.
Tengo nodded. "Tomorrow morning I have to take the train and go to the cat town again."
"You're going to the cat town?" Fukaeri asked without expression.
"You will be waiting here?" Tengo asked. Living with Fukaeri, he had become used to asking questions without question marks.
"I will be waiting here."
"I'll go to the cat town alone," Tengo said. He took a sip of coffee. Then it suddenly occurred to him to ask her, "Do you want something to drink?"
"White wine, if you have some."
Tengo opened the refrigerator to see if he had any chilled white wine. In back, he found a bottle of Chardonnay he had recently bought on sale. The label had a picture of a wild boar. He pulled the cork, poured some into a wine glass, and placed it before Fukaeri. After some hesitation, he poured himself a glass as well. He was definitely more in the mood for wine than coffee. It was a bit too chilled and a bit too sweet, but the alcohol calmed Tengo's nerves somewhat.
"You'll be going to the cat town tomorrow?" Fukaeri asked again.
"I'll take a train first thing in the morning," Tengo said. Tipping back his glass of white wine, Tengo recalled that he had ejaculated into the body of the beautiful 17-year-old girl now sitting across the table from him. It had happened only the night before, but it seemed like something that had occurred in the distant past, almost a historical event. Still, the sensation of it remained as vivid as ever inside him. "The number of moons increased," Tengo said, as if sharing a secret, slowly turning the wine glass in his hand.
"When I looked at the sky a little while ago, there were two moons, a big yellow one and a small green one.
They might have been there from before, but I never noticed them. I finally realized it just a little while ago." Fukaeri had nothing to say regarding the fact that the number of moons had increased, nor could Tengo discern any sense of surprise at the news. Her expression had not changed at all. She did not even give her usual little shrug. It did not appear to be news to her.
"I don't have to tell you that having two moons in the sky is the same as the world of Air Chrysalis," Tengo said. "And the new moon looks exactly as I described it, the same size and color."
Fukaeri had nothing to say. She never answered questions that needed no answers.
"Why do you think such a thing has happened? How could such a thing have happened?"
Still no answer. Tengo decided to ask her directly.
Could this mean that we have entered into the world depicted in Air Chrysalis?
Fukaeri spent several moments carefully examining the shapes of her fingernails. Then she said,
"Because we wrote the book together."
Tengo set his wine glass on the table. Then he asked Fukaeri,
"We wrote Air Chrysalis and published it. It was a joint effort. Then the book became a bestseller, and information regarding the little people and Mazas and Dotas was revealed to the world. As a result of that, you and I together entered this newly altered world. Is that what it means?"
"You are acting as a receiver."
"I am acting as a receiver," Tengo said, echoing her words. "True, I wrote about receivers in Air Chrysalis, but I didn't understand any of that. What does a receiver do, specifically?"
Fukaeri gave her head a little shake, meaning she could not explain it.
"If you can't understand it without an explanation, you can't understand it with an explanation," Tengo's father had said.
"We had better stay together," Fukaeri said, "until you find her."
Tengo looked at Fukaeri for a time, trying to read her expression, but as always, there was no expression on her face to read. Unconsciously, he turned aside to look out the window, but there were no moons to be seen, only an ugly, twisted mass of electric lines.
"Does it take some special talent to act as a receiver?"
Fukaeri moved her chin slightly up and down, meaning that some talent was required.
"But Air Chrysalis was originally your story, a story you wrote from scratch. It came from inside of you. All I did was take on the job of fixing the style. I was just a technician."
"Because we wrote the book together," Fukaeri said, as before.
Tengo unconsciously brought his fingertips to his temple. "Are you saying I was acting as a receiver from then on without even knowing it?"
"From before that," Fukaeri said. She pointed her right index finger at herself and then at Tengo.
"I'm a perceiver and you're a receiver. In other words, you perceive things and I receive them."
Fukaeri gave a short nod. Tengo frowned slightly.
"So you knew that I was a receiver, or had a receiver's special talent, and that's why you let me rewrite Air Chrysalis. Through me, you turned what you had perceived into a book. Is that it?"
No answer. Tengo undid his frown. Then, looking into Fukaeri's eyes, he said,
"I still can't pinpoint the exact moment, but I'm guessing that around that time I had already entered this world with two moons. I've just overlooked that fact until now. I never had occasion to look up at the night sky, so I never noticed that the number of moons had increased. That's it, isn't it?"
Fukaeri kept silent. Her silence floated up and hung in the air like fine dust. This was dust that had been scattered there only moments before by a swarm of moths from a special space. For a while, Tengo looked at the shapes the dust had made in the air. He felt he had become a two-day-old evening paper. New information was coming out day after day, but he was the only one who knew none of it.
"Cause and effect seemed to be all mixed up," Tengo said, recovering his presence of mind. "I don't know which came before and which came after. In any case, though, we are now inside this new world."
Fukaeri raised her face and peered into Tengo's eyes. He might have been imagining it, but he thought he caught a hint of an affectionate gleam in her eyes.
"In any case, the original world no longer exists," Tengo said.
Fukaeri gave a little shrug.
"We will go on living here."
"In the world with two moons."
Fukaeri did not reply to this. The beautiful 17-year-old girl tensed her lips into a perfectly straight line and looked directly into Tengo's eyes, exactly the way Aomami had looked into the 10-year-old Tengo's eyes in the empty classroom, with strong, deep mental concentration. Under Fukaeri's intense gaze, Tengo felt he might turn into stone, transforming into the new moon, the lopsided little moon. A moment later, Fukaeri finally relaxed her gaze. She raised her right hand and pressed her fingertips to her temple, as if she were trying to read her own secret thoughts.
"You are looking for someone?" the girl asked.
"Yes."
"But you didn't find her?"
"No, I didn't find her,"
Tengo said. He had not found Aomame, but instead he had discovered the two moons. This was because he had followed Fukaeri's suggestion to dig deep into his memory, as a result of which he had thought to look at the moon. The girl softened her gaze somewhat and picked up her wine glass. She held a mouthful of wine for a while and then swallowed it carefully, like an insect sipping dew. Tengo said, "You say she's hiding somewhere. If that's the case, it won't be easy to find her."
"You don't have to worry," the girl said.
"I don't have to worry," Tengo echoed her words. Fukaeri nodded deeply. "You mean I'm going to find her?"
"She is going to find you,"
Fukaeri said in a voice like a breeze passing over a field of soft grass. "Here, in Koenji." Fukaeri inclined her head to one side, meaning she did not know.
"Somewhere,"
she said. "Somewhere in this world," Tengo said. Fukaeri gave him a little nod.
"As long as there are two moons in the sky."
Tengo thought about this for a moment and said with some resignation, "I guess I have no choice but to believe you."
"I perceive and you receive," Fukaeri said thoughtfully.
"You perceive and I receive," Tengo said. Fukaeri nodded. "And is that why we joined our bodies?" Tengo wanted to ask Fukaeri. "In that wild storm last night, what did that mean?" But he did not ask those questions, which might have been inappropriate, and which he knew she never would have answered.
"If you can't understand it without an explanation, you can't understand it with an explanation," Tengo's father said somewhere.
"You perceive and I receive," Tengo repeated once again. "The same as when I rewrote Air Chrysalis." Fukaeri shook her head. Then she pushed her hair back, revealing one beautiful little ear, as though raising a transmitter's antenna.
"It is not the same," Fukaeri said. "You changed."
"I changed," Tengo repeated. Fukaeri nodded. "How have I changed?" Fukaeri stared for a long time into the wine glass she was holding, as if she could see something important inside.
"You will find out when you go to the cat town," the beautiful girl said.
Then, with her ears still showing, she took a sip of white wine.
Chapter 23 Aomame, Put a Tiger in Your Tank. Aomame woke at just after 6 o'clock in the morning. It was a clear, beautiful day. She made herself a pot of coffee, toasted some bread, and boiled an egg. While eating breakfast, she checked the television news to confirm that there was still no report of the Sakigake leader's death. They had obviously disposed of the body in secret, without filing a report with the police or letting anyone else know. No problem with that. A dead person was still a dead person no matter how you got rid of him. At 8 o'clock she showered, gave her hair a thorough brushing at the mirror, and applied a barely perceptible touch of lipstick. She put on stockings. Then she put on the white silk blouse she had hanging in the closet and completed her outfit with her stylish Junko Shimada suit. While shaking and twisting her body a few times to help her padded underwire bra conform more comfortably to her shape, she found herself again wishing that her breasts could have been somewhat bigger. She must have had that same thought at least 72,000 times while looking in the mirror. But so what? I can think what I want as many times as I want. This could be the 72,001st time. But what's wrong with that? As long as I'm alive, I can think what I want, when I want, any way I want, as much as I want, and nobody can tell me any different. She put on her Charles Jourdan high heels. She stood at the full-length mirror by the front door and checked to see that her outfit was flawless. She raised one shoulder slightly and considered the possibility that she might look something like Faye Dunaway in the Thomas Crown Affair. Faye Dunaway played a cool-headed insurance investigator in that movie. A woman like a cold knife, sexy, great-looking in a business suit. Of course, Aomame didn't look like Faye Dunaway, but the atmosphere she projected was somewhat close, or at least not entirely different. It was that special atmosphere that only a first-class professional could exude. In addition, her shoulder bag contained a cold, hard, automatic pistol. Putting on her slim Ray-Ban sunglasses, she left the apartment. She crossed the street to the playground, walked up to the slide where Tango had been sitting, and replayed last night's scene in her head. It had happened 12 hours earlier. The actual Tango had been right there, just across the street from me. He sat there for a long time alone, looking up at the moons. The same two moons that she had been looking at. It felt almost like a miracle to Amame. A kind of revelation that she had come so close to Tango. Something had brought her into his presence. And the event, it seemed, had largely reconstructed her physical being. From the moment she woke up in the morning, she had continued to feel a sort of friction throughout her entire body. He appeared before me and departed. We were not able to speak to or touch each other. But in that short interval, he transformed many things inside me. He literally stirred my body and mind the way a spoon stirs a cup of cocoa, down to the depths of my internal organs and my womb. She stood there for a full 5 minutes, one hand on a step of the slide, frowning slightly, jabbing at the ground with the sharp heel of her shoe. She was checking the degree to which she had been stirred both physically and mentally, and savoring the sensation. Finally, she made up her mind, walked out of the playground to the nearest big street, and caught a cab. "I want you to go out to yoga first, then take the Metropolitan Expressway No. 3 inbound until just before the Ikejiri exit," she announced to the driver, who was understandably confused by these instructions. "So, miss, can you tell me exactly what your final destination is?" he asked, his tone rather on the easygoing side. "The Ikejiri exit, for now." "Well, then, it would be much closer to go straight to Ikejiri from here. Going all the way out to Yoga would be a huge detour, and at this time of the morning, the inbound lanes of number 3 are going to be completely jammed. They'll hardly be moving. I'm as sure of that as I am today is Wednesday."
"I don't care if the expressway is jammed. I don't care if today is Thursday or Friday or the Emperor's birthday. I want you to get on the Metropolitan Expressway from Yoga. I've got all the time in the world."
The driver was a man in his early 30s. He was slim with a long, pale face, and looked like a timid grazing animal. His chin stuck out like those of the stone faces on Easter Island. He was looking at Amame in his rear-view mirror, trying to decide from her expression whether his current passenger was totally bonkers or just an ordinary human being in a complicated situation. It was not easy for him to tell, though, especially from the image in the small mirror. Amame took her wallet out of her shoulder bag and thrust a brand-new 10,000 yen bill toward his face. The money looked as if it had just been printed. "No change needed and no receipt," Amame said curtly. "So keep your opinions to yourself and do what you're told. Go first to Yoga, get on the expressway, and go to Ikejiri. This should cover the fare even if we get caught in traffic."
"It's more than enough, of course," the driver said, though he still seemed dubious. "Do you have some special business on the expressway?"
Amame shook the bill at him like a pennant in the wind. "If you don't want to take me, I'll get out and find another cab. So make up your mind, please, now." The driver stared at the 10,000 yen bill for a good 10 seconds with his brows knit. Then he made up his mind and took the money. After holding the bill up to the light to check its authenticity, he shoved it into his business bag.
"All right then, let's go. Metropolitan Expressway No. 3. It's going to be badly backed up, though, I'm telling you, miss. And there's no exit between Yoga and Ikejiri. No toilet, either. So if there's any chance you might need to go, better take care of it now."
"Don't worry. Just take me straight there." the driver made his way out of the network of residential streets to Ring Road number 8 and joined the thick traffic heading for yoga. Neither he nor Ah Mama said a word. He listened to the news, and she was lost in thought. As they neared the entrance to the Metropolitan Expressway, the driver lowered the radio's volume and asked Ah Mama a question.
"This may be none of my business, miss, but are you in some special line of work?"
"I'm an insurance investigator," Ah Mama said without hesitation.
"An insurance investigator?"
The driver repeated her words carefully, as if tasting a new food. "I find evidence in cases of insurance fraud," Ah Mama said.
"Wow," the driver said, obviously impressed. "Does Metropolitan Expressway number 3 have something to do with this insurance fraud stuff?"
"It does indeed."
"Just like that movie, isn't it?"
"What movie?"
"It's a really old one, with Steve McQueen. I don't remember what it's called."
"The Thomas Crown Affair," Ah Mama said.
"Yeah, that's it. Faye Dunaway plays an insurance investigator. She's a specialist in theft insurance. McQueen is this rich guy who commits crimes for fun. That was a great movie. I saw it when I was in high school. I really liked the music. It was very cool."
"Michel Legrand." The driver hummed the first few bars of the theme song. Then he looked in the mirror for another close look at Ah Mama.
"Come to think of it, miss, something about you reminds me of Faye Dunaway."
"Thank you," Ah Mama said, struggling somewhat to hide the smile that formed around her lips. The inbound side of Metropolitan Expressway number 3 was, as the driver had predicted, beautifully backed up. The slowdown started less than 100 yards from the entrance, an almost perfect specimen of chaos, which was exactly what Ah Mama wanted. The same outfit, the same road, the same traffic jam. Unfortunately, Janáček's Sinfonietta was not playing on the car radio, and the sound quality didn't measure up to that of the stereo in the Toyota Crown Royal Saloon, but that would have been asking for too much. The cab inched ahead, hemmed in by trucks. It would stay in one place for a long time, and then unpredictably creep ahead. The young driver of the refrigerated truck in the next lane was absorbed in his manga magazine during the long stops. The middle-aged couple in a cream Toyota Corona Mark II sat looking straight ahead, frowning, but never saying a word to each other. They probably had nothing to talk about, or maybe they had talked, and now they were silent as a result. Ah Mama settled deeply into her seat. The taxi driver listened to the broadcast on his radio. The cab finally passed a sign for Komazawa as it continued to crawl along toward Sanganjaya at a snail's pace. Ah Mama looked up now and then to stare out the window.
"I won't be seeing this neighborhood anymore. I'm going somewhere far away."
But she was not about to start feeling nostalgic for the streets of Tokyo. All the buildings along the expressway were ugly, stained with the soot of automobile exhaust, and they carried garish billboards. The sight weighed on her heart. "Why do people have to build such depressing places? I'm not saying that every nook and cranny of the world has to be beautiful, but does it have to be this ugly?" Finally, after some time, a familiar area entered Ah Mama's field of vision. The place where she had stepped out of the cab. The middle-aged driver had told her, as if hinting at some deeper significance, that there was an emergency stairway at the side of the roadway. Just ahead was a large billboard advertising Esso gasoline. A smiling tiger held up a gas hose. It was the same billboard as before. "Put a tiger in your tank." Ah Mama suddenly noticed that her throat was dry. She coughed once, thrust her hand into her shoulder bag, and took out a box of lemon-flavored cough drops. After putting a drop in her mouth, she returned the box to the bag. While her hand was in there, she gave the handle of the Heckler & Koch a strong squeeze, reassured by its weight and hardness. "Good," she thought. The cab moved ahead somewhat. "Get into the left lane, will you?" Almamas said to the driver. "The right lane is moving better," he objected softly, "and the Ikajiri exit is on the right. If I get into the left lane here, I'll just have to move over again." Almame was not ready to accept his objections. "Never mind, just get into the left lane."
"If you say so, miss," the driver said with resignation.
Leaning over and sticking his hand out the front passenger window, he signaled to the refrigerated truck behind him in the left lane. After making sure the driver had seen him, he raised the window again and squeezed the cab into the left lane. They moved ahead another 50 yards until the traffic came to a full stop again.
"Now open the door for me. I'm getting out here," Almama said.
"Getting out?" the driver asked, astonished. He made no move to pull the lever that opened the passenger door.
"Here?"
"Yes, this is where I'm getting out. I have something to do here."
"But we're in the middle of the Metropolitan Expressway. It would be too dangerous to get out here, and even if you did, there's no place you could go."
"Don't worry, there's an emergency stairway right there."
"Emergency stairway?" He shook his head. "I don't know if there's an emergency stairway or not, but if anyone found out I let a passenger out in a place like this, I'd be in big trouble with the cab company and the expressway management company. So please, miss, give me a break."
"Sorry. I have to get out here," Almama said. She took another 10,000 yen bill from her wallet, gave it a snap, and shoved it at the driver. "I know I'm asking you to do something you shouldn't. This will pay for your trouble. So please stop arguing and let me out." The driver did not take the money, but he gave up and pulled the lever. The left side passenger door opened.
"No, thanks. You've already paid me more than enough. But please be careful. The expressway doesn't have shoulders, and no matter how backed up the traffic might be, it's very dangerous for anybody to walk up here."
"Thank you," Almama said. After stepping out, she knocked on the passenger side front window and had him lower the glass. Leaning inside, she thrust the 10,000 yen bill into the driver's hand.
"Never mind, just take it. Don't worry, I have more money than I know what to do with."
The driver looked back and forth between the bill and Almama's face. Almama said, "If this gets you into trouble with the police or the company, just tell them I threatened you with a pistol. You had no choice but to let me out. That'll shut them up." The driver seemed unable to grasp what she was saying. More money than she knew what to do with? Threatened him with a pistol? Still, he took the money, probably fearing that she might do something even more unreasonable if he refused. Just as she had done before, Almame made her way between the expressway sidewall and the cars in the left lane, heading toward Shibuya. She had some 50 yards to pass. People in the cars looked at her, incredulous, but Almame did not let them bother her. She walked ahead with long, confident strides, her back straight, like a fashion model on the Paris runway. The wind stirred her hair. Trucks speeding along the wide-open lanes heading in the other direction shook the roadway. The SO billboard grew larger as she approached, until finally she reached the familiar emergency turnout. Everything looked as it had before. The metal barrier, the yellow box next to it containing an emergency telephone. "This is where the year 1Q84 started," Almame thought. "One world took the place of another from the time I climbed down this emergency stairway to Route 246 below. So I'm going to try climbing down again. The first time I did it, it was April, and I was wearing my beige coat. Now it's early September, and the weather is too hot for a coat. Aside from the coat, though, I'm wearing exactly the same outfit I had on that day, when I killed that awful man who worked in oil. My Junko Shimada suit and Charles Jourdan high heels. white blouse, stockings and white underwire bra. I pulled my miniskirt up to step over the barrier and climbed down the emergency stairway from here. I'll try doing the same thing again, purely out of curiosity. I just want to know what will happen if I do the same thing in the same place wearing the same outfit. I'm not hoping this will save me. I'm not especially afraid to die. If it comes to that, I'll do it without hesitation. I can die smiling. But Al-Mamed did not want to die ignorant, failing to grasp how things worked. I want to push myself to my limits, and if things don't work out, then I can give up. But I will do everything I can until the bitter end. That is how I live. Al-Mamed leaned over the metal barrier and looked for the emergency stairway. It was not there. She looked again and again with the same result. The emergency stairway had vanished. Al-Mamed bit her lip and twisted her face out of shape. This is not the wrong place. It was definitely this turnout. Everything around here looks the same. The SO billboard is right there. The emergency stairway existed in that place in the world of 1984. Al-Mamed had found it easily, exactly where the strange taxi driver had said it would be. She had been able to step over the barrier and climb down. But in the world of 1Q84, the emergency stairway no longer existed. Her exit was blocked. Al-Mamed untwisted her face and carefully observed her surroundings. She looked up at the SO billboard again. Gas hose in hand, curly tail held high, the tiger looked out from the frame with a sly, knowing glance and a happy smile. A smile so utterly joyful, it seemed to say that any greater satisfaction was an impossibility. Yes, of course, Al-Mamed thought. She had known it from the start. Leader had said so before she killed him in the Hotel Okura suite. There was no way to return from 1Q84 to 1984. The door to this world only opened in one direction. Even so, Al-Mamed needed to confirm this fact with her own two eyes. It was her nature, and now she had confirmed it. It was all over. The proof was finished. QED. Al-Mamed leaned against the metal barrier and looked up at the sky. The weather was perfect. Several long, narrow clouds traced straight lines across a deep blue background. She could view the sky far into the distance. It didn't seem like a city's sky, but there were no moons to be seen. Where could the moons have gone? Oh, well, a moon is a moon, and I am me. Each of us has a different way to live. We each have our own plans. If she had been Faye Dunaway, at this point Al-Mamed would have taken out a slim cigarette and coolly lit it with a cigarette lighter, elegantly narrowing her eyes. But Al-Mamed did not smoke, and she had neither cigarettes nor a lighter with her. About all she had in her bag was a box of lemon cough drops. That, plus a steel 9mm automatic pistol, and a specially made ice pick she had used to stab a number of men in the back of the neck. Both might be somewhat more lethal than cigarettes. She looked at the backed-up line of cars. Inside their vehicles, people were staring intently at her. Of course. Not often did people have the chance to see an ordinary citizen walking along the Metropolitan Expressway, and especially not a young woman wearing a miniskirt and spike heels with green sunglasses and a smile on her lips. Anyone who did not look must have something wrong with them. The majority of vehicles stuck on the roadway were large trucks. They were bringing all sorts of goods from all sorts of places to Tokyo. The drivers had probably been at the wheel all night, and now they were stuck in this faded morning traffic jam. They were bored, fed up, and tired. All they wanted was to take a bath, shave, lie down, and go to sleep. They stared blankly at Aomame, as if they were looking at some unfamiliar animal. They were too tired to engage with her positively. Wedged between these mini trucks, like a graceful antelope caught in a herd of clumsy rhinoceros, was a silver Mercedes-Benz coupe. Its beautiful body, looking fresh from the factory, reflected the newly risen morning sun. Its hubcaps had been color-coordinated with the body. The car was an import, with its steering wheel on the left side. The driver's window was down, and a well-dressed, middle-aged woman was looking straight at Aomame. Givenchy sunglasses, hands visible on the steering wheel, rings glittering. The woman had a kind face, and she seemed to be worried about Aomame. She was obviously wondering what a well-dressed young woman was doing out on the roadway of the Metropolitan Expressway, and what could have caused her to be there. She looked ready to call out to Aomame. If asked, she might drive her anywhere she wanted to go. Aomame took off her Ray-Bans and put them in the pocket of her suit top. Squinting in the bright morning light, she spent some time rubbing the dents left on either side of her nose by the glasses. She ran her tongue across her dry lips and caught the faint taste of lipstick. She looked up at the clear sky and checked the ground under her feet once. She opened her shoulder bag and slowly drew out the Heckler & Koch, dropping the bag at her feet to free up her hands. With her left hand, she released the safety catch and pulled back the slide, sending a round into the chamber. She performed the sequence of movements rapidly and precisely with a few satisfying clicks. She lightly shook the gun in her hand, testing its weight. The gun itself weighed 480 grams, to which the weight of 7 bullets was added. No question it's loaded. She could tell by the difference in weight. A smile still played around Aomame's straight lips. People were focused on her actions. No one was surprised to see her pull a gun out of her bag. Or at least they did not show surprise on their faces. Maybe they didn't believe it was a real gun. It is, though, Aomame told them mentally. Next, she turned the gun upward and thrust the muzzle into her mouth. Now it was aimed directly at her cerebrum, the gray labyrinth where consciousness resided. The words of a prayer came to her automatically, with no need to think. She intoned them quickly with the muzzle of the gun still in her mouth. Nobody can hear what I am saying, I'm sure. But so what? As long as God can hear me. When a little girl, Aomame could hardly understand the phrases she was reciting, but the words had permeated her to the core. She had to be sure to recite them before her school lunches, all by herself, but in a loud voice, unconcerned about the curious stares and scornful laughter of the other children. The important thing is that God is watching you. No one can avoid his gaze. Big Brother is watching you. O Lord in heaven, may thy name be praised in utmost purity forever and ever, and may thy kingdom come to us. Please forgive our many sins, and bestow thy blessings upon our humble pathways. Amen. The nice-looking middle-aged lady at the wheel of the brand-new Mercedes-Benz was still looking straight at Aomame. Like the other people watching, she seemed unable to grasp the meaning of the gun that Aomame was holding. If she understood, she would have to look away from me, Aomame thought. If she sees my brain splatter in all directions, she probably won't be able to eat her lunch today, or her dinner. I won't blame you if you look the other way, Aomame said to her wordlessly. I'm not over here brushing my teeth. I've got this German-made automatic pistol, a Heckler & Koch shoved in my mouth. I've said my prayers. You should know what that means. Here is my advice to you. Important advice. Don't look at anything. Just drive your brand new Mercedes-Benz straight home. Your beautiful home. where your precious husband and children are waiting, and go on living your peaceful life. This is not something that someone like you should see. This is an ugly pistol, a real gun loaded with 7 ugly 9mm bullets. And, as Anton Chekhov said, once a gun appears in a story, it has to be fired at some point. That is what we mean by a story. But the middle-aged lady would not look away from Amame. Resigned, Amame gave her head a little shake. Sorry, but I can't wait any longer. My time is up. Let's get the show on the road. Put a tiger in your tank. Ho, ho, said the keeper of the beat. Ho, ho, the 6 other little people joined in. Tango, said Amame, and started to squeeze the trigger.
Chapter 24. Tango. As long as this warmth remains. Tango took a morning special express train from Tokyo Station to Tateyama, changed there to a local, and rode it as far as Chikura. The morning was clear and beautiful. There was no wind, and there was hardly a wave to be seen on the ocean. Summer was long gone. He wore a thin cotton jacket over a short-sleeved shirt, which turned out to be exactly right for the weather. Without bathers, the seaside town was surprisingly deserted and quiet. Like a real town of cats, Tango thought. He had a simple lunch by the station and took a taxi to the sanatorium, arriving just after 1 o'clock. The same middle-aged nurse greeted him at the reception desk, the woman who had taken his phone call the night before, Nurse Tamura. She remembered Tango and was somewhat friendlier than she had been the first time, even managing a little smile, perhaps influenced by Tengo's nicer outfit. She guided Tango first to the lunchroom and poured him a cup of coffee.
"Please wait here. The doctor will come to see you," she said.
10 minutes later, his father's doctor appeared, drying his hands with a towel. Flecks of white were beginning to appear among the stiff hairs of his head. He was probably around 50. He was not wearing a white jacket, as if he had just completed some task. Instead, he wore a gray sweatshirt, matching gray sweatpants, and an old pair of jogging shoes. He was well-built and looked less like a doctor than a college sports coach who had never been able to rise past Division II. The doctor told Tango pretty much the same thing he had said on the phone the night before. Judging from his expression and his words, he seemed genuinely saddened when he said, "I'm sorry to say there is almost nothing we can do for him medically at this point. The only thing left to do is let him hear his son's voice. It might enhance his will to live." "Do you think he can hear what people say?" Tango asked. The doctor frowned thoughtfully as he sipped his lukewarm green tea. "To tell you the truth, not even I know the answer to that. Your father is in a coma. He shows absolutely no physical response when we speak to him. There have been cases, though, where someone in a deep coma has been able to hear people talking, and sometimes even understand what was being said. But you can't tell by looking at them." "No, we can't." "I can stay here until 6:30 tonight," Tango said. "I'll sit with him all day and talk to him as much as possible. Let's see if it does any good." "Please, let me know if he shows any kind of reaction," the doctor said. "I'll be around here somewhere." A young nurse showed Tango to his father's room. She wore a name badge that read Adachi. His father had been moved to a private room in the new wing, the wing for more serious patients. In other words, the gears had advanced one more notch. There was nowhere else to move him after this. It was a drab little room, long and narrow, and more than half filled by the bed. Beyond the window stretched the pine woods that acted as a windbreak. The dense grove looked like a wall, separating the sanatorium from the vitality of the real world. The nurse went out, leaving Tango alone with his father, who lay on his back, sound asleep. Tango sat on a small wooden stool by the bed and looked at his father. Near the head of the bed stood an intravenous feeding device, the liquid in its plastic bag being sent into a vein in his father's arm through a tube. A catheter had been inserted to catch urine, surprisingly little of which had been collected. His father seemed to have shrunk another size or two since the month before. His emaciated cheeks and chin wore perhaps 2 days' growth of white beard. His father had always had sunken eyes, but now they were more deeply set than ever. Tengo couldn't help wondering if it might be necessary to pull the eyeballs up from their holes with some kind of medical device. His eyelids were tightly shut at the bottoms of those caverns like lowered shutters, and his mouth was slightly open. Tengo couldn't hear his father's breathing, but bringing his ear close, he could feel the slight movement of air. Life was being quietly maintained there at a minimal level. The doctor's words on the phone last night, like a train dropping its speed little by little as it begins to stop, began to feel terribly real to Tengo. This father train was gradually lowering its speed, waiting for its momentum to run down, and preparing to come to a quiet stop in the middle of an empty prairie. At least there was no longer a single passenger aboard, no one to raise a complaint even if the train came to a halt. That was the only salvation. Tengo felt he ought to start talking to his father, but he did not know what he should say, how he should say it, or what tone of voice to use. "All right, say something," he told himself, but no meaningful words came to mind. "Father," he ventured in a whisper, but no other words followed. He got up from the stool, approached the window, and looked at the well-tended lawn and garden and sky stretching high above the pine woods. A solitary crow sat perched on a large antenna, glaring at the area with disdain as it caught the sunlight. A combination transistor radio alarm clock had been placed near the head of the bed, but his father required neither of its functions. "It's me, Tengo. I just came from Tokyo. Can you hear me?" he said, standing at the window, looking down at his father, who did not respond at all. After vibrating in the air for a moment, the sound of his voice was absorbed without a trace by the void that had come to occupy the room. "This man is trying to die," Tengo thought. He could tell by looking at the deeply sunken eyes. He made up his mind to end his life, and then he closed his eyes and went into a deep sleep. "No matter what I say to him, no matter how much I try to rouse him, it will be impossible to overturn his resolution." Medically speaking, he was still alive, but life had already ended for this man. He no longer had the reason or the will to continue to struggle. All that Tengo could do was respect his father's wishes and let him die in peace. The look on his face was utterly tranquil. He did not seem to be suffering at all. As the doctor had said on the phone, that was the one salvation. Still, Tengo had to speak to his father, if only because he had promised the doctor that he would do so. The doctor seemed to be caring for his father with genuine warmth. Secondly, there was the question of what he thought of as courtesy. Tengo had not had a full-fledged conversation with his father for a very long time, not even small talk. The truth was that Tengo had probably been in middle school the last time they had had a real conversation. Tengo hardly ever went near their home after that, and even when he had some business that required him to go to the house, he did his best to avoid seeing his father. Now, having made a de facto confession to Tengo that he was not his real father, the man could lay down his burden at last. He looked in some way relieved. "That means that each of us was able to lay down his burden at the last possible moment." Here was the man who had raised Tengo as his own son, listing him as such in the family register despite the absence of blood ties, and raising him until he was old enough to fend for himself. "I owe him that much. I have some obligation to tell him how I have lived my life thus far, as well as some of the thoughts I have had in the course of living that life," Tengo thought. "No, it's not so much an obligation as a courtesy. It doesn't matter if the things I am saying reach his ears, or whether telling him serves any purpose." Tengo sat on the stool by the bed once again and began to narrate a summary of his life to date, beginning from the time he left the house and started living in the judo dorm when he entered high school. From that time onward, he and his father had lost nearly all points of contact, creating a situation in which neither had the least concern for what the other was doing. Tengo felt he should probably fill in such a large vacuum as best he could.
Ultimately, however, there was almost nothing for Tengo to tell about his life in high school. He had entered a private high school in Chiba Prefecture that had a strong reputation for its judo program. He could easily have gotten into a better school, but the conditions offered him by that school were the best. They waived his tuition and allowed him to live in the dormitory, providing him with 3 meals a day. Tengo became a star member of the judo team, studied between practice sessions. He could maintain some of the highest grades in his class without having to study too hard. And he earned extra money during vacations by doing assorted manual labor with his teammates. With so much to do, he found himself pressed for time, day after day. There was little to say about his 3 years of high school, other than that it was a busy time for him. It had not been especially enjoyable, nor had he made any close friends. He never liked the school, which had a lot of rules. He did what he had to do in order to get along with his teammates, but they weren't really on the same wavelength. In all honesty, Tengo never once felt totally committed to judo as a sport. He needed to win in order to support himself, so he devoted a lot of energy to practice in order not to betray others' expectations. It was less a sport to him than a practical means of survival, a job. He spent the 3 years of high school wanting to graduate so that he could begin living a more serious life as soon as possible. Even after entering college, however, he continued with judo, living basically the same life as before. Keeping up his judo meant he could live in the dormitory and thus be spared any difficulty in finding a place to sleep or food to eat, minimal though it was. He also received a scholarship, though it was nowhere nearly enough to get by on. His major was mathematics, of course. He studied fairly hard and earned good grades in college, too. His advisor even urged him to continue into graduate school. As he advanced into the 3rd year and then the 4th year of college, however, his passion for mathematics as an academic discipline rapidly cooled. He still liked mathematics as much as ever, but he had no desire to make a profession of research in the field. It was the same as it had been with judo. It was fine as an amateur endeavor, but he had neither the personality nor the drive to stake his whole life on it, which he well knew. As his interest in mathematics waned and his college graduation drew near, his reasons for continuing judo evaporated, and he had no idea what path he should next pursue. His life seemed to lose its center of gravity, not that he had ever really had one, but up to that point, other people had placed certain demands and expectations upon him, and responding to them had kept him busy. Once those demands and expectations disappeared, however, there was nothing left worth talking about. His life had no purpose. He had no close friends. He was drifting and unable to concentrate his energies on anything. He had a number of girlfriends during his college years and a lot of sexual experience. He was not handsome in the usual sense. He was not a particularly sociable person, nor was he especially amusing or witty. He was always hard up for money and wasn't at all stylish. But just as the smell of certain kinds of plants attracts moths, Tengo was able to attract certain kinds of women, and very strongly at that. He discovered this fact around the time he turned 20, which was just about the time he began to lose enthusiasm for mathematics as an academic discipline. Without doing anything about it himself, he always had women who were interested enough to take the initiative in approaching him. They wanted him to hold them in his big arms, or at least they never resisted him when he did so. He couldn't understand how this worked at first, and reacted with a good deal of confusion, but eventually he got the hang of it and learned how to exploit this ability, after which Tengo was rarely without a woman. He never had a positive feeling of love toward any of them, however. He just went with them and had sex with them. They filled each other's emptiness. Strange as it may seem, he never once felt a strong emotional attraction to any of the women who had a strong emotional attraction to him. Tengo recounted these developments to his unconscious father, choosing his words slowly and carefully at first, more smoothly as time went by, and finally with some passion. He even spoke as honestly as he could about sexual matters. "There's no point getting embarrassed about such things now," he told himself. His father lay face up, unmoving, his deep sleep unbroken, his breathing unchanged. A nurse came before 3 o'clock,
changed the plastic bag of intravenous fluid, replaced the bag of collected urine with an empty one, and took his father's temperature. She was a strongly built, full-bosomed woman in her late 30s. The name on her tag read Omura. Her hair was pulled into a tight bun on the back of her head, with a ballpoint pen thrust into it.
"Has there been any change in his condition?"
she asked Tengo, while recording numbers on a clipboard with the ballpoint pen.
"None at all. He's been fast asleep the whole time," Tengo said.
"Please push that button if anything happens," she said,
pointing toward the call switch hanging over the head of the bed. Then she shoved the ballpoint pen back into her hair.
"I see."
Shortly after the nurse went out, there was a quick knock on the door, and bespectacled Nurse Tamura poked her head in.
"Would you like to have a bite to eat? You could go to the lunchroom."
"Thanks, but I'm not hungry yet," Tengo said.
"How is your father doing?"
Tengo nodded. "I've been talking to him the whole time. I can't tell whether he can hear me or not."
"It's good to keep talking to them," she said.
She smiled encouragingly.
"Don't worry, I'm sure he can hear you."
She closed the door softly. Now it was just Tengo and his father in the little room again. Tengo went on talking. He graduated from college and started teaching mathematics at a cram school in the city. No longer was he a math prodigy from whom people expected great things, nor was he a promising member of a judo team. He was a mere cram school instructor. But that very fact made Tengo happy. He could catch his breath at last. For the first time in his life, he was free. He could live his own life as he wanted to without having to worry about anyone else. Eventually, he started writing fiction. He entered a few of his finished stories in competitions, which led him to become acquainted with a quirky editor named Komatsu. This editor gave him the job of rewriting Air Chrysalis, a story by a 17-year-old girl named Fukaeri, whose real name was Eriko Fukada. Fukaeri had created the story, but she had no talent for writing, so Tengo took on that task. He did such a good job that the piece won a debut writer's prize from a magazine and then was subsequently published as a book that became a huge bestseller. Because the book was so widely discussed, the selection committee for the Akutagawa Prize, the most prestigious literary award, kept their distance from it. So while it did not win that particular prize, the book sold so many copies that Komatsu, in his typically brusque way, said, "Who the hell needs that?" Tengo had no confidence that his story was reaching his father's ears, and even if it was, he had no way of telling whether or not his father was understanding it. He felt his words had no impact, and he could see no response. Even if his words were getting through, Tengo had no way of knowing if his father was even interested. Maybe the old man just found them annoying. Maybe he was thinking, "Who gives a damn about other people's life stories? Just let me sleep." All Tengo could do, though, was continue to say whatever came to his mind. He couldn't think of anything better to do while crammed into this little room with his father. His father never made the slightest movement. His eyes were closed tightly at the bottom of those two deep, dark hollows. He might as well have been waiting for winter to come and the hollows to fill up with snow.
"I can't say that things are going all that well for the moment, but if possible, I'd like to make my living by writing. Not just rewriting somebody else's work, but writing what I want to write, the way I want to write it. Writing, and especially fiction writing, is well suited to my personality, I think. It's good to have something you want to do, and now I finally have it. Nothing of mine has ever been published with my name on it, but that ought to happen soon enough. I'm really not a bad writer, if I do say so myself. At least one editor gives me some credit for my talent. I'm not worried on that front."
"And I seem to have the qualities needed to be a receiver," Tengo thought of adding. "So much so that I have been drawn into the fictional world that I myself have written." But this was no place to start talking about such complicated matters. That was a whole different story. He decided to change the subject. "A more pressing problem for me is that I have never been able to love anyone, seriously. I have never felt unconditional love for anyone since the day I was born. Never felt that I could give myself completely to that one person. Never once." Even as he said this, Tengo found himself wondering if this miserable-looking old man before him had ever experienced loving someone with his whole heart. Perhaps he had seriously loved Tengo's mother, which may have been why he was willing to raise Tengo as his own child, even though he knew they had no blood tie. If so,